From my laboratory to yours, it's The Other Animals for New Year's Day 2021. I'm Laurent Levy. Thanks for starting off the new year with us. So it looks like we made it. 2020 is finally in our rearview mirror. I guess it's customary on a show like this to pause at this time for a sense of retrospection and to look back at the highs and lows of the year just concluded. But that was 2020, and we all know what that's about. All right, but still, the idea is to try to sum up those highs and lows so we can try and understand what that was all about, so we might be able to predict what's coming up, or at least slow it down a little bit. Well, in the world of the human and non-human animals, we too had our highs and lows, and they might help us see what's coming too. So let's start with the highs. For highs, I'd have to say that the waters from the floodgates that opened up in 2019, and I'm talking about the normalization of plant-based foods as an option and the progress toward destigmatization of all that lifestyle suggests, certainly seems to be continuing to pour downstream. More and more startups have entered the cruelty-free space, and the largest traditional meat producers in the world have taken notice, either by buying up those startups or by investing in R&D of their own. Those companies, as we've mentioned on the show, are really in the protein-producing business. If it helps their bottom line to cut out the live animal component, it'll happen. And the transition from animal-based protein to alternatives, along with the health, cost, and environmental benefits that go along with them, is knocking on the door of the mainstream. Those alternatives include not just plant-based options, but so-called cultured meat grown in the laboratory rather than on the muscle of an otherwise innocent sentient individual. Singapore became the first country in the world to approve the use of such a product as an ingredient in chicken nuggets just a couple weeks ago. We also had other highs, including the curious impact the COVID-19 virus had on animal shelters, causing a supply shortage and in some cases even empty shelters, probably for the first time that many can remember. We also saw new initiatives to develop alternatives to leather and other non-food-based animal products. We saw the continued growth of the animal sanctuary movement, including for whales and cetaceans. We saw success in conservation efforts, resulting in one example in the resurgence of the California condors, previously thought to be on the verge of extinction. We saw the development of sophisticated animatronics with the promise of replacing live animals in zoos and entertainment. And we also saw similar technology developed and deployed to replace the use of live animals in science and education. Middle schoolers will soon no longer be taught that it's okay to kill a live individual just to see what's inside. And activist organizations such as Animals for Action, Showing Animals Respect and Kindness, and Akashinga continued the struggle to end horrific cruelty in the forms of rodeo, bullfighting, cockfighting, pigeon shoots, and poaching. And finally, technology is showing stunning promise in its ability to develop better, more human-like models, those are the so-called organoids, to help to aid in vaccine development and produce more realistic and reliable testing protocols to bring safer and more effective drugs to market in record times. But, as you can guess, we also had a few lows. Well, in my opinion, actually just really one large one. Despite wiping out over 1.8 million humans around the world, and we're still counting, and despite the undeniable evidence that the roots of COVID-19 are directly related to the way humans interact with non-humans, and more specifically, when that interaction assumes as normal and acceptable that we humans can do bloody well whatever we want to those non-humans, that underlying foundation of human exceptionalism persists. As I feared earlier, we're getting the vaccine and rolling right back to our old habits. We just don't want to read that memo. Take a look, for example, towards the bottom of any of the online versions from the major news sources, you know, pretty much any of them, you know, the big ones, New York Times, CNN, Fox, whatever. And you'll usually see some kind of recipe or food article where the use of a previously living individual as a principal ingredient for that recipe is completely acceptable. Last week, for instance, New York Times featured an article entitled, "How Will We Eat in 2021? 11 Predictions to Chew On." The article featured a high-resolution image of a roast duck dinner celebrating its new affordability and accessibility. Further down, there were chicken, beef, and pork barbecues, again celebrating the diversity found among the various states. And the Washington Post offered up a delicious make-ahead cheesy ham casserole as a festive treat at the holidays or anytime. Not to be outdone, Fox offered up maple glazed meatballs. Those kinds of recipes, as delectable and scrumptious as the images make them appear, whether they acknowledge it or not, fuel the kind of demand that gave rise to what we saw in the Wuhan market. In the States, we call them CAFOs, or confined animal feeding operations, but it's really the same thing. Live animals completely at our mercy. And until we start showing some, and I'm talking about mercy, we're not going to be able to produce vaccines fast enough. That's our challenge. And that's what I hope we can look forward to, really making 2021 better than 2020. All right. On that optimistic note, we have a positive, forward-looking show for today. We're going to continue our conversation that we started a couple weeks ago with Dr. Jared Bailey from the Center for Contemporary Sciences on the strange state of animal genetics and how that impacts humans. Could we, and should we, for instance, develop genetically altered animals to grow organs or drugs for us? And a bit later on, Dr. Tom Picard of All Pets House Calls is going to look at what happens when we have the happy ending of a successful return of a lost pet, what we should and shouldn't do, and just as importantly, steps you can take to try to prevent them from getting lost in the first place. But before any of that, it's time for Animals in the News. All right, two stories today. One very positive comes from CNN. You may have actually seen this. We have this case. It takes place in Kenya, where we have a stranded bunch of giraffes. They were stuck on a floating island in Kenya. They'd been living on a peninsula that reached out into Lake Baringo. But rising lake levels caused by lots of rain, relentless rain, had gradually turned the peninsula into an island, leaving the animals stranded. Conservationists had teamed up with Kenyan wildlife authorities and local members of the community to start moving the giraffes off the island and onto a new sanctuary within the 44,000-acre Ruko Conservancy. The initial hope was that they'd be able to coax the giraffes onto a barge by putting mangoes and other treats there. But because of the rainy season, there has been an abundance of food on the islands. In other words, the giraffes were quite happy. They weren't hungry. So the treats would not be enough. So that meant that giraffes would have to be hit with the tranquilizer dart. And that is an especially dangerous proposition because of their anatomy. When giraffes go down on the ground, they can choke on their own saliva, or their brains can be damaged by the changes in blood pressure. I guess when you stand up in the morning and we're only however tall we are, well, imagine being as tall as a giraffe is and getting the blood up to the brain. So it's important that once the giraffe falls, the vet is there to immediately counteract the drug with a reversal drug. After the giraffe is down, they put guide ropes around the shoulders and a blindfold over their eyes to keep them calm. And then they sort of lead them onto the barge. That's the hard part. Once they get them on the barge, it's apparently relatively smooth sailing. And the barge arrives at this island. They take the blindfold off, and the giraffe ambles off as though nothing has happened. There's a lot more detail if you want to head over to CNN. You can CNN.com. You can see pictures. It's a nice story, nice positive story of lots of humans trying to help out their non-human companions. Good positive, nice way to start the new year. All right, the next story we have comes from a source we haven't used before. It's called Stat. According to its website, it is a, quote, media company focused on finding and telling compelling stories about health, medicine, and scientific discovery. That might be a clue to what you're about to hear. So listen to the tone of this story. The headline is FDA approves genetically altering pigs to potentially make food, drugs, and transplants safer. Here is the article. Genetically engineering pigs so they lack a certain sugar on the surface of their cells that triggers meat allergies or organ rejection, won approval from the Food and Drug Administration earlier in December. The regulatory clearance, the first of an intentional genomic alteration in a product with both food and medical uses, means the animals could be safer sources of not just food, but also treatments such as the blood thinner known as heparin. Quote, today's first ever approval of an animal biotechnology product for both food and as a potential source for biomedical use represents a tremendous milestone for scientific innovation, FDA Commissioner Stephen Hahn said in his statements. Just as an aside here before I keep reading, it's very interesting that with all the attention that the FDA was getting, of course, in the rush to get both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines approved, this was also happening in the background. This was happening at the same time. And of course, not getting nearly as much attention or nearly as much press. Just keep that in the back of your mind. Let me keep going here. There have been four previous approvals for such genetic engineering animals, three for biomedical purposes and one for food, but none for both biomedicine and food. Stephen Solomon, director of FDA's Center for Veterinary Medicine, said, GalSafe pigs, it's GalSafe, named for their lack of detectable alpha-gal sugar, could potentially provide tissues and organs for patients without the danger of rejection caused by the presence of the sugar in cross-species procedures known as xenografts, that's spelled with an X, or xenotransplantation, also spelled with an X. Alpha-gal is considered a primary cause of rejection, Solomon said, but he was hesitant to say it's the only source. I think that people need to be careful, Solomon said. That's why, in part, it's going to require further evaluation for xenotransplantation, xenograft, or the other activities by the medical products centers, and FDA. People with alpha-gal syndrome, a condition that causes mild to severe allergic reaction to alpha-gal sugar found in the red meats, beef, pork, and lamb, might also benefit. I'm going to stop there. Might there not be another way that they can avoid getting this thing? I don't know. Maybe they could try to eat something other than beef, pork, and lamb. Maybe. It's just a thought. I'm throwing it out there. All right, back to the story. The allergic reaction recently identified in the United States occurs after a Lone Star tick bites and then transmits alpha-gal sugar into a person's body. Some people develop an immune reaction that later erupts into mild to severe allergic responses after eating the alpha-gal sugar in meat. All right, and this goes on and on, but you get the sense here. This is a very technical. It really makes no bones, no pun intended, to even confront the possibility of an ethical consideration, the use of the animals. It is 100% purely from the biomedical human point of view. Okay, well, that's what the Stat magazine and the Stat source is all about. Can it or should it really be that pure? I think that needs to be discussed. I think that needs to be looked at. And so, funny I should say that, when we come back, I set this all up. Dr. Jared Bailey from the Center for Contemporary Sciences is, in fact, going to help us unpack this very story and all the problems it raises. We'll be right back with Dr. Bailey. Don't go away.
You're likely listening to this at home, in your car, or somewhere warm. How would you feel if you were left in the bitter cold all night long, chained up? Please, take your dogs inside. Your dog is not going to be smarter or tougher because you make him suffer. Your dog is your partner. Treat him like a partner. If you're not respecting your animals, you're not respecting yourself. Do not leave your animals out in the cold. Please visit PETA.org to learn more.
We're science. Elastic tubes and pots and pans. Bits and pieces and magic from the handle. Make it weird science.
All right. Welcome back to the Other Animals on WWDB. We're joined again. This is a part two of our conversation that we started a couple weeks ago with Dr. Jared Bailey. He's with the Center for Contemporary Sciences. He has a PhD in genetics from Newcastle University, and he's the director of science and technology with the CCS, the Center for Contemporary Sciences. When we were talking a couple weeks ago about the fascinating and promising advances that are available to us with new methods for testing that do not involve animals. And what I'd like to pick up today on the second part we didn't get to, there is this concept of genetic engineering. And we heard about it earlier today on the news story that I read about the FDA approving genetically engineered pigs because they lack a certain sugar on the surface of their cells and it triggers meat allergies or organ
rejection, which won approval from the FDA a couple weeks ago. And I just wonder if we could talk about that. So what do we know about this process of genetically engineering pigs? Let's set aside for just a second the horrible ethics of of this thing of genetically engineering any sentient animal for our own purposes. But what can you tell us about this process and the prognosis for genetically engineering animals?
Yeah, speaking as a geneticist, my background is in genetics. It's if you push ethics to one side, it's fascinating. I mean, how genes work and how they're regulated and how they make who and what we are is really, really fascinating. And genetically modifying, ideologically, genetically modifying organisms is a really fascinating prospect. The problem, of course, as you mentioned, is that ethically, it's really not a great thing to do. And there are a number of reasons for that. Firstly, animals in labs who are genetically modified are genetically modified to try and find out what genes do, to try and recreate a human disease. So you've got a mouse model of that disease to do lots of research on, lots of which can be really harmful and involve a lot of suffering and death. So from an ethical perspective, it's really not a nice thing to do. And it's one of the issues. It's something I've written about many times. Firstly, are GM animal models of human diseases any good scientifically? And the answer is overwhelmingly, they're not. And there are reasons for that. Genes, even the same genes, where, you know, when we share them, they do things differently in different ways, with different effects in different organisms, even in different individuals of the same species, because genes are very, very tightly regulated things. So their environment really, really matters. But they've been a failure in many, many, many ways. I put a slide up in a talk I was giving recently that showed all of the different areas of research in which some GM animals had been reported as failures, and it's right across the board. But there is a huge ethical issue to this, and that's that making GM animals remains even now with less bad methods. Some of your listeners will have heard of a method known as CRISPR, which is being used to make genetically modified animals.
Right. So I don't know that term.
CRISPR, and it's CRISPR. And actually, the two inventors of the technique just won a Nobel Prize for it. But it was the subject of a book chapter I wrote a year or two ago, because even though it's the least bad method we've got, it still suffers from a lack of efficiency. So a very small percentage of any animals born have the genetic modification you want them to have. So the vast, vast majority, often 90 something percent, don't have the genetic modification you want and either die before or around or just after birth, or they're killed because, you know, when they're analyzed, they're not exactly what you wanted. Even the animals that have the modification you want, quite often they don't necessarily behave as you want. There are huge problems with unwanted off-target effects. And I've likened that to playing darts, with a handful of darts instead of just one. You might hit the target you want, but you're going to hit lots and lots of other targets that you don't want to hit. And when you're talking about genes, really tightly controlled genes, that you really, really don't want that to happen. Ethically, because you can cause all sorts of problems that cause suffering and death. And also scientifically, because how on earth do you know what you're seeing? Is the, you know, which effect are you actually seeing, or which combination of effects? There's also a huge problem with on-target effect. And I've likened that to playing darts with an anti-aircraft gun. You'll hit the board, but you'll also take out the board, the wall, the house in which the board was, and so on and so forth. It remains a very inefficient, very imprecise process, and that is not scientifically good at all. And certainly, this is meant to ultimately be applied to human beings, to edit human genes that might have gone faulty, to make them right. But we're talking about a process that is inefficient and very, very imprecise, and that can have really nasty effects on the individual. And this is not being taken seriously enough because, as we spoke about last time, you have a lot of scientists around the world who want to tinker, who want to make things, who want to write up their results and publish papers and get money to do it again and again and again. And that's, unfortunately, what drives some science.
I hear in this particular, with this model of genetic engineering, the story we're talking about, of course, are the pigs. But I know it is a massive industry to, you can go get catalog shop rodents, right? Mice and rats, and select the components. Literally online, I'd like it to be colorblind. I'd like it to have this pigmentation. I'd like it, you know, the tail to be whatever. There's a whole shopping cart of qualities and parameters that a researcher can literally order from these manufacturers, and you will get, you know, the UPS truck will pull up, and instead of delivering you a nice batch of COVID vaccine, will deliver you, you know, 7,000 gray rats with a particular genetic ailment that you could test. And there's huge numbers in that, huge numbers. And that's got to be in play, right? I mean, just the sheer volume.
Yeah, no, you know, just as you were talking, I pulled up one of the slides that I presented, and it says here GM, genetically modified animals welfare issues, and these are in databases of animals that have been genetically modified to see what happens. And the first point I made is that more than half of GM animals that are born and that are show some desired effect, more than half of them suffer some form of pain or discomfort, and that's often severe, and ends up in them dying. But some of the things that are listed in these databases of GM animals, I mean, and these are animals that have, you know, been bred to be like this. You have skeletal abnormalities, enhanced tumor growth, seizures, degenerative joints, blindness, hearing problems, tremors, paralysis, respiratory distress, internal bleeding, and many, many more. I mean, I think this is the thing, that these animals are actually created to be born to suffer until they're killed. And I think ethically, you know, that's going to be an issue for a lot of people. And then when you add to that the scientific side of things, which is, well, how much good have these animals done for science? It compounds this situation and makes it even worse, because it's such shoddy science. And because no matter what you do, bear in mind the inefficiency and the poor specificity I've already talked about. No matter what you do to a GM animal, if you put a human gene into a mouse, that gene will be in a mouse, and that matters. It really, really matters in terms of how that gene's regulated and expressed and what it interacts with and the job it does. It's in a mouse. And by the way, many, many scientific papers have shown that you can have genes that are essential for life in one species that are dispensable in another, and vice versa, that you can have, genes that, for example, protect against cancer in one species that actually promote cancer in another. And this is the point. This is the same gene. It's just in a different type of animal. It's complete. It's just poor science to do this and pretend that it has some value. There is much, much better science that we can do. And, you know, that's what we're always coming back to. As I mentioned to you before, we really are at an unprecedented opportunity now. We can correct everything that's gone before, all of the scientific failures in terms of trying to understand what a human disease is, why people get it, how we can prevent it, treat it, cure it. All of those failures, we now have an unprecedented opportunity to change that and to change it to real success by using human-specific methods, by these amazing organoids and organ-on-a-chip and body-on-a-chip, these human-specific technologies that we've spoken about. And if we don't embrace this as a matter of urgency, you know, we will at some point, because we have to, because the science is so wonderful, it demands we have to. But what, as I said, what we don't want to do is look back in 20 years' time and wish we'd done this much sooner, because somebody's going to put a number on the human lives that we could have improved and saved if we'd done this sooner. And that's going to be a huge regret.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, as you were talking, I'm thinking, as we've been sort of talking through these sessions, we've kind of kept saying the ethics side, because obviously we could spend hours, you know, really delving into the ethics. And yet there's a part of me, as we're talking, that says maybe it's even superficial of us, if that's the right word, to attempt to put the ethics aside. I mean, it should almost be baked in that we need to consider that if we're genetically engineering, as you were describing, animals to bring them in this world for no other reason than to suffer, that their existence, and we know that they suffer, right? As far as neurologically, we've done that research. Actually, just a quick aside, I had a guest last year, Jonathan Balcom. I asked him, can you tell me if...
Jonathan so well. I really do. Right? Yeah.
Oh, I asked him, you know, can you tell me if a fish suffers? And he very quickly responded, I don't know if you suffer. And there, you know, that's, you know, really, that is the answer. We don't know, but we have a pretty good idea, right? And so if we're imposing this kind of harm on we're creating it, we're literally creating harm. And yeah. I don't know if you can do an ethical exercise on that to say, well, I create 100 million, you know, 100,000 rats that have, I don't know, you know, some sort of terrible palsy or something, and I can find a cure for humans. That's got to start factoring in. You know, that's got to factor into the equation, along with the shoddy science, as you say.
I mean, you know, I, on many, many levels, I completely agree with you. I really, really do. I think there is an issue that, and you know, for, I think what's particularly encouraging is most people agree. You know, when we look at opinion polls that have just asked very simple questions, you know, do you think these experiments should be banned? Consistently, a huge proportion of people, often a great majority of people, say yes, even if, for the sake of argument, there is some human benefit from them. That is just too much to bear, the thought of monkeys undergoing neuroscience and so on. So lots of people agree. I think the issue is a significant minority of people don't. And that's why I think sometimes it's important to say that while the animal ethical side of things and the human ethical side and the science are overlapped to some degree, it's also important that those arguments stand on their own as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes it stronger, because if you do just temporarily put ethics to one side, the scientific argument to move away from animal research and do better stands on its own. And I think that makes it even more powerful. But if I just bring in one last point, which I think is important, which illustrates the overlap, my most read paper, and this is actually a paper that some people I know suggested I wasn't really worth writing, and it's my most read paper. It's a paper about the stress that animals, and this is something Jonathan Balcom worked on too in the past, by the way, but it's about the stress, the chronic stress that animals in laboratories experience. But it's not just that it's a welfare issue, an ethical issue. Is it a scientific issue? Does stress, you know, we know that if we're stressed, it affects us physiologically. So what is the stress that animals in laboratories suffer doing to the results you get from the experiments in which you use those animals, and what does it mean? And what this paper shows is that stress is inflicted on them by so many variables. Just that it's an alien environment, different noises, different light, different routines, different foods, seeing their cage mates undergo various procedures that are stressful, anticipating harm from certain technicians. And there's all sorts of things about being in a lab, even over and above the procedures that are done to each individual that cause serious, significant chronic stress. And that stress affects their biology, often the biology of their immune systems, how they metabolize new drugs. And of course, these are important if you're studying infectious disease and, you know, if a new drug is safe and effective. So it makes a nonsense of the results that you're getting from those animals. And even worse, it can be transgenerational, because what stress can do is kind of, to put it simplistically, mark your DNA. And some of the marks that that stress puts on your DNA are heritable. You pass them on to other generations. So, for example, your biology can be changed because your grandmother had a really, really stressful life. Now, that's important if your grandmother happened to be a wild caught monkey in Mauritius that was then put in a breeding center and used to breed lots of monkeys who were then exported to labs all around the world in very, you know, stressful transport and then housed in stressful conditions and so on. The data you get from these damaged individual animals, for want of a better word, you can't even apply to a free living wild animal of the same species, because such is the difference in gene expression and what have you that's going on. So again, there is an overlap. This welfare issue, the ethics, matter scientifically as well, and we have to make that connection.
Exactly, that's the point. I mean, that is ultimately that there shouldn't, in fact, we shouldn't even be surprised in a way, if you think about it. Why should our science be divorced from our ethics? They should be very married, and it seems to me the best science, I don't know if you think, the best science is compassionate science, and the worst science is this, you know, where we are now, where it's okay to just bring creatures in the world and utterly disregard any possibility, any notion of the suffering, because we think we're entitled to do that, because only our potential suffering matters. Theirs absolutely does not. To me, there's an element of, ultimately, that is a self-defeating proposal, that you're gonna, that if you believe that, and if you approach the solution like that, it is doomed to fail. You cannot separate those two. Maybe that's far-reaching or pontificating, but it seems like that's where we're heading, right?
I think lots of people have had this attitude, this opinion for a long time, but I think where we are now is it is supported by an unprecedented amount of evidence. And that's what we always come back to. What is the evidence telling you? And it's telling everyone exactly what you just said, that this on every level, in every way, is bad science and bad ethics, and it's letting everybody down. And more people are starting to see this. And this is then, you know, the evidence also is showing that how many people around the world are getting this, because how much effort is being made to change things, to really develop alternative ways of doing things, better ways of doing things, which have existed for some time, but they're better than ever, and they're demanding we use them. But there's so much effort going on, and it's so encouraging to see. And I think there has been a real awakening. And as I said, everyone's going to benefit from that. But you know, to go back to these genetically modified pigs that you mentioned, I mean, that in one swoop illustrates everything. It illustrates the ethics, the suffering, the death, the poor science, the letting humans down, not just the animals. And it illustrates so much that's wrong with science. So just to illustrate that, for example, the last paper I published just a couple of months ago, actually, in BMJ Open Science, is on the exaggeration of animal research in the UK national press. So very briefly, what we did, we went back to 1995 to give any animal based breakthroughs time to transpire into human benefit. You know, we gave them the benefit of the doubt. We'll give you 20 plus years to work out. So we took these animal breakthroughs mentioned in the UK national press, specific breakthroughs, and followed them up. Only one out of 27 of these really high profile breakthroughs from animal research resulted in significant human benefit. And even then, there were serious caveats with that. One of the major failures was so-called xenotransplantation. And this is trying to grow organs in pigs and genetically modified pigs to transplant into people to overcome the organ shortage. And this is exactly what, you know, what's the FDA has just approved. They've approved these genetically modified pigs. The problem with that is that in 1995, in this report, they said that GM pigs, organs from GM pigs, would be in clinical trials within a year or two. They would be commonplace in transplantation within 5 years. Some even went even further and said, next year, 1996, we'll be doing this. Now, the problem is that the pigs that have just been approved have a particular genetic modification, and this was the first real major one that had ever been done. It had been done years ago, you know, 25 plus years ago. And they said this was going to change things. This was going to overcome organ rejection. And here we go. All we have to do is farm pigs. We've got as many organs as we can. It didn't work. So they tried some more genetic tweaking, and that didn't work. And they tried some more, and they tried some more. When I wrote about this,
each time they try this, right, we're manufacturing.
It didn't work. Yeah. So another batch. So they've tried. I think at the last count it was about 30 different genetic modifications of pigs, and looking at the ethics, it gets worse. They then transplant these organs often into monkeys, sometimes baboons, put them on huge amounts of immunosuppressive drugs that humans, by way beyond the level that humans could even support. By the way, to try and see how long these monkeys, these baboons with pig organs, can survive for. And it's only ever been a matter of months. And I'll repeat, and this is on huge levels of immunosuppressive drugs. It just doesn't work. The organs continue to be rejected. And yet we still see these promises 25 or so years later. We still see these promises that at some point, pigs are going to give us all the organs we need. And it's just not working. And it comes back to what we spoke about last time, which is some humility, some objectivity, some reflection, some scientific reflection. Have we been doing the right thing? Should we be doing something else? Yeah. And the evidence for a very long time has said exactly that. Stop wasting your time doing these awful experiments because they're ethically unsupportable, and because they're not working, because they're very, very unlikely to work. And there are approaches you can take to make more organs available for transplant that have worked in other countries. And just one final point. In the last time we spoke about, I think you made it as a kind of joke. Can you kind of print tissues and organs? And I said, yes, you can. It's called bioprinting. And one of the proposed bonuses of this ability to 3D print mini human organs eventually is to be able to track to print an organ using your own cells, so there's no prospect of rejection, to print an organ that you need for transplant using your own cells. And you know, there you go. It's ethical, it's quick, it's relatively cheap, and it's much, much more likely to work in the near future than continuing to genetically tinker with pigs and experiment on monkeys who live for a matter of months and live a very miserable existence for those few months.
Well, you know what? That's a positive note. That's a positive. So we're out of time, and I'm glad we kind of ended on an optimistic optimistic note there. So listen, as we've been talking for actually both weeks, you've mentioned a lot of your publications. Where can people go to if they wanted to read about them? Do you have any mass market?
Yes,
or anything like that?
Yeah. Thank you for that. All my papers from the last, 25 years or so, but specifically the last 15, 16 years, while I've been publishing papers about the use of animals in research and what we can do and should be doing instead, they're all on my page on a website called ResearchGate. So if your listeners go to ResearchGate and look me up, Jarrod Bailey, JARRODBAILEY. They'll be able to find me and download all of my papers and read them with interest and get in touch if they have any comments or questions, which I'm always very happy to receive.
Excellent. And also your organization, the Center for Contemporary Sciences, where can people go to get more information about that?
Yeah, that's contemporarysciences.org. And we've only been in existence for 6, 7, 8 months or so. So we're a very new organization, but we are already doing really good, promising things, and have lots more planned. And I would love it if your listeners could visit our website and see who we are and what we're about and what we have planned. That would be great.
Awesome. So and I've been there. Definitely, I would recommend checking it out. I do hope we'll be able to check in with you from time to time, because I see your work as incredibly promising. It bears so much hope and optimism and promise for where our research and where our health decisions, and really, if there's nothing else that comes out of the lesson from this pandemic, I hope this at least shines some light on that and gets the word out. So thanks again. That's Dr. Jared Bailey. He's the director of science and technology with the Center for Contemporary Sciences. Thanks so much for your time, Jared.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
All right, when we return, Dr. Tom Picard of All Pets House Calls will take a look at the happy ending. What should we do when we're reunited with a lost pet? And how should we make sure it doesn't happen in the first place? We'll be right back.
Medicine is magical, and magical is art. Think of the boy in the bubble and the baby with the babbling heart. And I believe...
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
We think our vet is very helpful. We think our vet is smart.
And we're back here on WWDB, joined now by Dr. Tom Picard of All Pets House Calls. Hey, Tom, how are your holidays?
Yes, I'd like to say Happy New Year to everyone. Maybe it's wishful thinking, but I'll say it anyway.
That's it. You got it. You have to. So you have to be. You have to believe it. You know, wishful thinking.
It's just a number. It's just a number. It's psychologically, it'll be good to move on.
There you go, and the power of positive thinking and all that, right?
For sure.
Yeah. Hey, well, so listen, so on that topic of positive outcomes, so I thought this time of year, for whatever reason, a lot of our dogs and cats get out. They get lost. And it's a different, you know, the recovery for a dog and cat is different, but it's still incredibly traumatic when you think they're lost, because your mind goes off in a million different directions as to what happened to them. And I've just been through it just last week, one of my cats that was gone for 11 days, it came back. And I think I mentioned it on the air, one of my other cats a few years ago was gone for almost 3 months in the dead of winter. So I thought I want to work my way backwards. When that happens, when you bring, when you have a recovery, when you have a successful recovery, and the first thing that we do, particularly in the wintertime, is I want to bring, in this case, it's my cat, to you. I want to bring it to the vet because I'm concerned of a lot of different things. So I wonder if we could talk first from that way. What do you do when you have this potential happy outcome that you found your pet? It seems like the first thing you should do is bring it to the vet. But as the vet, what are you looking for? What are you advising your clients to do once they found the pet? And then once they bring them to you, what are you looking for upon a return, particularly, let's say, in the wintertime? You
know? Sure, absolutely. And we'll certainly double back on a little bit of potential prevention of the problem.
Okay, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
But let's assume it's happened and you've had the happy result of finding them. One thing that's very critical for the veterinarian is knowing how many days they've been missing.
Okay.
If it's 1 day, 2 days, something like that, maybe even 3, Chances are things have been okay. I mean, obviously, we're going to check them head to toe. Did they pick up, well, even in the winter, did they pick up fleas, depending on where you live? Did they pick up any other parasites? You'll check like a fecal sample on them, maybe worm them anyway as a precaution. Did, you know, listen to the heart and lungs? Did they sound like they picked up any sort of infection? Yeah, eyes, ears, nose, everything. One thing people don't realize, though, is that if they have been gone for maybe more than 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, even longer, I believe your cat was 10 days, wasn't it?
Yeah, mine was 11 days.
11, yeah, that's a long time. Yeah. So what happens is we don't know if they've had, of course, food and water. It's like amazing they can survive that long.
Yeah.
But one of the first inclinations that of an owner is, of course, they probably lost a little weight, maybe, if they've gone that long. You want to give them food and water.
Absolutely.
But that can be very dangerous, especially in our cats. Because cats particularly have a problem where if they've been without nutrients like that for that period of time, to suddenly give them that can really throw their liver and their kidneys into a tailspin. So we have to be very slow and careful, and with dogs as well. At the very least, they're not used to digesting things and all that, but it can make them, you know, their liver and their kidneys go just really in a bad state. We have to do it very slowly with very small amounts.
I mean,
just gradually build it up.
They're potentially those organs, they shut down, right? I mean, mm-hmm. speaking, colloquially, but that's what happens, right? If those organs aren't used, they begin to shut down. You can't just turn it back on like an ignition switch, right? And that's the
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Cats particularly will get a condition of a fatty liver where the liver just starts to metabolize in bizarre and very bad ways for the body. And then suddenly giving them food can just really just wreak havoc within them. So things have to be done very slowly. That's why usually with at a veterinarian hospital, especially if they've been gone that long, we just start with, you know, very, you know, slow drip IVs just to bring them back up to speed. With they're usually going to be dehydrated. That's another problem. You suddenly give them all this fluid and they've been dehydrated. That fluid can just cause problems. It can start to back up their with their blood pressure and volumes. It can start to create fluid accumulations in their lungs and around their heart, and be fatal. So it's very serious. Yeah,
I mean, because you would think when the pet comes back into the house and they head for the water bowl, you would think, good, oh my goodness, yeah, because the poor thing's been thirsty. But you're saying you got to be careful with that and not just turn them loose.
Yes, absolutely. Ice cubes, if you want to give them something, give them an ice cube. They can just casually lick that while you wait to get to the vets. You know, get a little bit of that dry mouth out.
Okay, so speaking of ice cubes now, we're sort of couching this under this time of year. And in both of my instances, it was cold. I mean, it was the one cat that I've talked about who was out for over almost 4 months. It was the dead of winter. This is going back several years, and it was a brutal, brutal winter. And so I, you know, you're thinking hypothermia, you're thinking all these things, and yet somehow, I mean, they survive. But what is the exposure factor this time of year when it's really cold? Do we worry about when they come back in? I know, like with people, you're not supposed to, if there is frostbite, you don't just immediately warm them back up. Or do we even have to worry about that?
I know you definitely do, because the spots where that'll be a problem, pads on their feet, their tip of their nose, their ears, all of those are very susceptible to frostbite. And you don't want to warm them up too quickly either. You don't want to put them in hot water, warm water. All of those things can really severely damage the skin. You look, it's classic, just like people, if you can see areas of exposed skin, and that could also be the rectal area, all sorts of areas. Some animals also have areas in their body. Some cats across their temples don't have a lot of fur just normally. Anything like that that doesn't have good fur coverage, if you can see, just like people, you can start to see like a blanched area of the skin. It's paler. It doesn't, when you maybe gently press on it, the color doesn't return to that area. That's an area of definite concern. And, you know, again, we have to evaluate that and slowly, maybe with just some warm water bottles done by a professional, of course, just slowly bringing their body temperature. And, you know, then you can watch those feet, the toes will peel off the skin. They could be limping for a while after that if they lose the skin on their pads, you know. So cold weather is bad
for a long. Here's another thought. Suppose your pet that has been out for a while is one that has been on medication. Let's say, in my case, it was not, but it could have been, because one of my cats, in fact, is on something that he gets on every meal. Maybe it varies. You're going to tell me it varies on whatever the medication is, but do we worry about all that time of the dosage being missed? And is there any, do we make it up? Do we try to do anything like that? Or do we just get back to it? Or what are the considerations, I guess, for medication in those instances?
Absolutely is a problem, much like, if not probably worse than the food and water scenario, because depends on the condition. If they've been off of their medication for a while, whether it be for, you know, diabetes or thyroid, anything, you can't make up the difference. Same as when we tell people, it's like, if you miss a dose, even if it's a day, don't double up on the next one, just do it at the regular time. And if you miss more than that, you probably need to go in, have blood drawn, things like that, just to see what effect the missed medication has had on the body. Mm-hmm. And you might need to slowly increment that medicine back up, as if they're maybe starting on it all over again, because they might not be used to it. Like over time, some animals, most conditions, that medication will increase slowly over time, because they get resistance to it, or they just need more. The actual problem gets resistant to the medicine. So again, you have to, it's almost like you're starting all over again with that problem. Don't give it to them. They've been missing for a while, I got to get their medicine. No, you know, definitely talk to your vet, take them to the vet, make sure that that's, you know, what they recommend before doing anything like that, because that can be fatal as well.
All right. So it's just like with humans, don't double down. All right. So we have a couple extra minutes. So let's, I don't know if we'll get to all of it here, but let's get into this topic of all right, we've got the happy ending. Let's talk about preventing the potential unhappy ending in the first place. What are some of the basic ways that we want to keep our pets from getting lost in the first place?
Certainly the simplest starts inside the house. I mean, you should be always checking, you know, your doors, your gates outside are closed. My own dog, when he was only a year old, we're up in Vermont, northern Vermont. It was going down to like -25, -30 that night. I went out to go get drop off my skis to get sharpened and left. And of course, I closed the door. It's probably one of the kids, you know, just left the door open and he disappeared. Well, I got blamed for it because I was the last person who had left the house.
Of course.
And it's like, well, I didn't know. And of course, we're in a panic. And suddenly he shows up in the back of a state trooper's car.
Oh,
and
my God.
The state trooper was ready to read us the riot act, but he saw how everybody was in a total panic. And he realized that, you know, we were searching frantically for him, but he was about to really, you know, give us the business because what it was going to be that night.
Wow.
But that's the first thing. Also gates, you know, kids are running around. They don't think about gates. Again, my dog was about a year and a half then. Kids were over a birthday party. I went inside to get something for them. Gate got left open. Dog ran out, got hit by a car.
Oh, man.
So that was not a fun 12th birthday for my son.
Lord.
So he survived. He had about 9 days in the hospital and he got out early because of me. You know, so
gates
are critical. Yes. And
it sounds so basic and logic, you know, and well, of course, you know, a gate, keep your door closed, you know. And yet
it can happen. So I have personally returned many a pet to people because they've had a collar with a name and address and phone number on them. Very, very, very useful and important. And on top of that, with today's technology, highly recommended if you can to get them microchipped.
Yeah.
These the needles that get delivered in kind of look like a miniature harpoon. So they're a little bit daunting, but you know, it seems like most of them tolerate it pretty well. And it's this little microchip that goes underneath their skin, usually between the shoulder blades. Now you can't typically feel it or know it's there, but they do come with a tag too that states that the animal has one. So that's one of the first things animal shelters will check. And that's of course where you should check too. Call every animal shelter in your an animal hospital in your area. Give them the description of everything about your pet who's missing. Tell them that they have a, maybe they don't have a collar on, or tell them that they do. Tell them that they have a microchip if they do have one. Most hospitals and shelters, there's multiple brands of microchips. Most of them carry devices to read all of the brands, and it'll bring up all the pertinent information, like your phone number and your address, which is super important. You may never get them back otherwise.
You know, that one I can speak to from personal experience. We have our, well, it's one of them, but that it's such a quick little procedure. The cats, they don't mind it at all. They barely feel it. And it actually, by the way, it has a potential secondary benefit in that they've got these, this is maybe a topic for another day too, but they've got these individualized feeders where the door opens up only for a particular cat you want, which is useful, for example, if they're on a prescription medicine or prescription food or something, and it'll read the chip. It'll read that microchip. And just another fringe benefit to having that process done. But you know, the main reason to do it is for finding it. It's such a simple, it's not an expensive procedure either, and it's just it's an added peace of mind.
Right, and I believe some of the more modern ones now, depending, I think some of them even have their own tracking devices that you could have an app on your phone and, you know, possibly tracking them down yourself.
Yeah, that's actually low. So those are the RFIDs, and from what I've seen them, they don't that needs a collar. It's not a thing that's not a subdermal thing.
Yeah, that type of thing, not the ones under the skin. But I mean, anything you can do to identify your pet as being your pet and knowing, because a lot of times, you know, they might see, say your animal has a disease condition. That after they've maybe been off of medicine for a while, they look kind of ragged, they're not feeling well. Some of those animals will unfortunately get put down very quickly at depending on the shelter, because they appear to be suffering. They don't know necessarily, they're not going to put the money into finding out what your animal's problem is. And that's, you know, certainly a terrible ending.
You don't
want to see that.
Okay, let's not end it on the bad note though. So let's do those precautions and keep our pets safe. So that we're out of time.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Let's have a better year.
Keep
our pets healthy, happy, safe, and in home and on the couch in front of the TV where they belong.
That's right. Chasing their tails and amusing us to know. All right. There you go. Thanks a lot. So that's all the time we have. Listen, I want to thank my guest, Jared Bailey. And again, just to thank all my guests for 2020 to help made that year really memorable. You know, hopefully in a more constructive way than some of the ambient news that we heard around us. And again, I want to take this time to thank everyone at WWDB for their help and support, and of course wish everyone there a happy new year. Love to hear from you with your comments, ideas, or suggestions. If there are topics you'd like Dr. Picard to address, please check out theotheranimals.com and let us know. Follow me on Twitter at @theotheranimal1, and same for Facebook. Don't forget to check out our partner podcasters at iroarpod.com. Next week, would you be surprised to learn that the meat industry has a bestiality problem? Well, you shouldn't. I mean, when you think of it, there has to be some way to keep all those cows and pigs pregnant all the time. Well, Dr. Gabriel Rosenberg from Duke University just published a truly astonishing article that looks at the way we conveniently rewrite our laws and our norms when it comes to so-called animal husbandry. In some states, it might still be considered, are you ready for this? Sodomy. All right, be sure to check us out then. Until then, find a belly to rub, stay safe, and have a very happy new year, everyone.